Hi, and thanks for joining me for Stories from the Phoenix New Times. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook. First on this week's program, four Zips employees face criminal charges stemming from ICE raid. This story was written by Zach Buchanan and was posted on the Phoenix New Times website on January 30th. Four Zips Sports Grill employees are facing criminal charges as a result of the massive Homeland Security investigation raids on the chain's 15 Valley locations on January 26th. The U.S. Attorney for the District of Arizona announced the criminal indictments Thursday evening. In total, 39 people were arrested in the raids, according to federal authorities. It's not clear if the 35 people who are not facing criminal charges are instead facing civil immigration charges. Spokespersons for the U.S. Attorney's Office and for Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the parent agent of HSI, did not immediately return messages seeking clarification. Three employees, identified as Ludwin Benjamin Perez Velasco, Edwin Flores Rosales, and Salvador Villanueva Rosas, face charges of filling out fraudulent I-9 forms, which are used to verify employment eligibility. A fourth employee, 36-year-old Diego Armando Gonzalez Rosales, faces five charges stemming from his alleged role in providing stolen identities to undocumented employees for the purpose of filling out their I-9 forms. Gonzalez Rosales, who the indictment says oversees all the Zips kitchens, faces two charges of making false attestations on an I-9 form, one charge of transferring means of identity without authority, one charge of aggravated identity theft, and one charge of pattern and practice of knowingly employing unauthorized aliens. Villanueva Rosas is a 48-year-old Mexican citizen who has lived in the U.S. for nearly two decades. Velasco is a 22-year-old Guatemalan, telling investigators he paid 80,000 Guatemalan dollars to be smuggled through the desert into the U.S. in 2022. Flores Rosales, 28, did not have identification documents when picked up, his indictment says. Court documents show that a judge ordered Velasco and Villanueva Rosas to be detained pending trial, but no such order is associated with Gonzalez Rosales and Flores Rosales. Debbie Yang, the attorney for Gonzalez Rosales, responded to the charges against her client in an emailed statement. Mr. Gonzalez Rosales has been living in the United States for a decade as a productive, hardworking member of the community, Yang wrote. The allegations have made Mr. Gonzalez Rosales himself a vulnerable individual, a scapegoat for the actions and knowledge of the company. He looks forward to his day in court. New Times contacted the attorneys listed for the three other indicted men in court documents, but has not heard back. In an emailed statement, a Zips spokesperson wrote, "We are reviewing the government statements and filings. Because this remains an active matter, Zips cannot comment right now on purported allegations, investigative steps, or employee-specific information." According to probable cause statements filed with the indictments, HSI first began investigating Zips in February 2025. Not long after President Donald Trump re-entered office. The HSI Phoenix office, quote, received a tip that Zips employs illegal aliens in their kitchens and that management was aware that those employees were using fraudulent documents. In March, HSI served all 15 Zips locations and its corporate headquarters with a notice of inspection that required the company to produce all of its I-9 forms. HSI then took every Social Security number on those forms and requested the associated 2024 and 2025 wage reports from the Arizona Department of Economic Security. DES then provided the number of jobs that were attributed to each Social Security number during the second quarter of 2025. According to the indictments, that review showed that 76 ZIPS employees had between 3 and 42 active employers other than ZIPS during that period. Those employees had attested to being U.S. citizens in their paperwork. The DES reports showed multiple jobs and extremely high wages earned in the same quarter, the indictments read, which is consistent with aggravated identity fraud. Allegedly, at the center of that ring was Gonzalez Rosales. According to his indictment, Gonzalez Rosales' I-9 form fraudulently listed himself as a lawful permanent resident, but the 36-year-old Social Security number and alien registration numbers actually belonged to other people, with the latter belonging to a citizen of Gambia. Per the indictment, Gonzalez Rosales is actually undocumented, having entered the country illegally from Mexico 2 decades ago. The indictment accuses Gonzalez Rosales of running a complicated system of identity theft in order to employ undocumented immigrants in ZIPS kitchens. The probable cause statement for his indictment describes 2 interviews with undocumented immigrants arrested in Monday's raids, who do not appear to have been criminally charged, in which they describe Gonzalez Rosales helping them fill out fraudulent I-9 forms and other employment paperwork with fake names and IDs and Social Security numbers belonging to other people. Furthermore, the indictment says that Gonzalez Rosales would recycle these documents, using them for subsequent employees after those previously using them had left ZIPS. The stolen Social Security numbers used by one of the interviewed employees had earned more than $180,000 across 17 jobs in the second quarter of 2025, suggesting it was being used by multiple people. Gonzalez Rosales told investigators that he started as a dishwasher at ZIPS not long after crossing the border in 2006, eventually working himself up to his current position. He denied formally hiring anyone, but said ZIPS management pretty much hires whomever he recommends. He claimed that he is unaware of his employees' legal status, saying that the office staff are the ones who verify their documents. But he also told investigators that every manager knows that many of the IDs are fake, and that managers know that they can get through the E-Verify inspection with fake identity documents, and that they do not care. Gonzalez Rosales then went on to say that every cook in the restaurant is working under fraudulent identities, and that he helps employees fill out their documents, even though he and the manager knew the identities were fake. He denied providing physical IDs to people, but said that at least once he took a picture of someone else's ID to provide it to employees needing it to pass their employment verification check. He denied receiving money for doing so. He also allegedly admitted that there were multiple instances that ZIPS rehired the same person under multiple different names, and confirmed that stolen IDs would be passed down to future employees. The indictments for the other 3 charged employees allege that they received stolen identities in a similar manner. Next, a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on January 30th. Ex-Goodyear cop suspended for locking neglectful dad in a hot car. On a hot summer day in June 2024, ex-Goodyear police officer Justin Gaspar decided to give a suspect a taste of his own medicine. The man ended up in the hospital. Amid one of Phoenix's hottest summers on record, Gaspar came across an arguing couple whose children had been locked in the car for 15 minutes, even though the temperature reportedly reached about 110 degrees inside the vehicle. Gaspar arrested the father for endangerment after the man refused to provide his keys to let his 4 and 9-year-old children out of the car. After the arrest, the man's children were transferred to Phoenix Children's Hospital. As for the father, Gaspar had another treatment in mind. The cop placed the man in the prisoner compartment in the back of his patrol vehicle for a 15-minute drive to Goodyear's jail. Gaspar turned off the air conditioning for the prisoner compartment and closed his vehicle's partition, eliminating the man's access to air conditioning. When they arrived at the jail, Gaspar was informed that it couldn't accept prisoners, so he had to transport the man to the Goodyear Police Department. During that drive, Gaspar repeatedly turned the air conditioning in the vehicle's prisoner compartment on and off. The man began to complain of feeling ill and became unresponsive, prompting the cop to drive to the hospital. There, the man regained consciousness, was treated, and eventually released. Gaspar told his supervisor and medical staff that he thought the man was faking his medical condition. Gaspar was fired from the Goodyear Police Department and later pleaded guilty to one count of impingement or false imprisonment and was sentenced to 6 months of probation. That wasn't his last punishment. Last week, Arizona's Police Certification Board suspended Gaspar's peace officer certification for 3 years. The suspension is backdated and will expire in August of 2027. The board, known as the Arizona Peace Officer Standards and Training Board, or ASPOST, licenses all law enforcement officers in the state and is one of the few agencies in Arizona with the power to discipline police. The 12-member board includes Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays, 2 rural sheriffs, Summerton's police chief, Phoenix City Council member Kevin Robinson, and Ryan Thornell, director of the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation, and Reentry. In all honesty, my intent was to make him uncomfortable, 100%. I'm not going to deny that, Gaspar told the board at its January 21st meeting. I know it's not our job to punish, but if you could have seen the look on these kids' faces that day. The board opened an investigation into Gaspar in August of 2025. Gaspar and his attorney attended the January meeting to advocate against the revocation of his license. I made a horrible decision that day, Gaspar told the board. I know it was wrong. I got caught up in the moment. I take full responsibility. The board was not united in what to do about Gaspar's case. Coconino County Sheriff's Office Jail Commander Matthew Figueroa said he struggled with the decision because even on our worst day, we can't, for many reasons, take it out on our prisoners, our arrestees, or our inmates. Chief Deputy Attorney General Bill Mundell said he understood it's an emotional situation, you're dealing with children, but was concerned with Gaspar's meanness to teach him a lesson or something. In its first vote, the board split 6-6 on the question of revocation. The board also split when voting on a 2-year suspension. After Mundell said he'd vote for something that was a little more severe, the board voted for a retroactive 3-year suspension, which passed on a voice vote. It was not unanimous. When reached by Phoenix New Times after his testimony, Gaspar declined to comment. Other suspensions and investigations. In the first meeting of the year, the board also voted to punish 10 former and current law enforcement officers from across Arizona for various violations. Last year, the board punished 42 current and former officers. In addition to Gaspar, ex-Mesa officer Joel Height was one of the other officers suspended. In May of 2023, Height parked his vehicle in downtown Phoenix to attend a grand jury hearing. When he returned to his spot, he had received a ticket, which he turned over to his superiors. When he was questioned about where he parked, Height lied. Mesa police fired him in August of 2023. ASPO staff recommended that the board uphold the revocation of his certification, but the board ultimately handed down a 2-year retroactive suspension. Also penalized were ex-Marana officer Daniel Bond, who was suspended for a year after he broke into a truck during a binge drinking episode and was arrested. His attorney said he had a significant drinking problem, but had sought treatment at an outpatient facility. Oro Valley officer Joshua Klaus, who received a 12-month suspension for paying for an Uber for a DUI suspect, accepting cash from the individual, and then lying to his superior about it. Ex-Prescott Valley officer Kevin Waugh, who received a 12-month suspension for driving drunk and hitting his girlfriend's car. Ex-Gilbert officer Damian Gonzalez, who received a 6-month retroactive suspension for clocking into off-duty jobs before he got to the work site. Pima County Sheriff's Deputy Travis Gosson, who received a 12-month suspension after sexually harassing a female deputy he was training. Ex-Mesa officer Richard Rosales, who received a 12-month suspension after he drunkenly accused his partner of cheating and caused her to fall and break her ankle. Ex-Casa Grande officer Edgar Mejia, who received a 3-year suspension after he was arrested for aggravated assault, disorderly conduct, and criminal damage. The mother of his child claimed he insulted her with a baby monitor while in his car before throwing it out the window and onto the highway. And former Maricopa County Sheriff's Office recruit Shamar Matthews, whose certification application was temporarily denied for 12 months after he lied to his supervisor about going to the nurse's office during a break. The board also opened investigations into 5 current or former officers. That included former Tempe cop Latasha Hampton, who an ASPOST compliance specialist said deleted her taser logs on evidence.com after using the stun weapon on a suspect. Charges against Hampton for tampering with a public record were recommended to the Maricopa County Attorney's Office, but the office declined to prosecute. Hampton was terminated by the Tempe Police Department in April 2025. Other recruits and former officers who now face investigations are former Pima County Sheriff's Deputy Henry Pambound, who was terminated after rear-ending a pickup truck and leaving the scene without leaving a note or calling 911. Ex-Salt River Tribal Officer Stephanie Camarona Zayas, who released a DUI suspect who was likely impaired. Former Phoenix police recruit Saba Blos, who said he was injured and couldn't get out of bed after a no-call, no-show at the academy. His ride actually dropped him off somewhere other than the academy, where his wife picked him up. And former Eloy police recruit Dylan Stone, who said in paperwork that he had never used cocaine, but admitted he used it once when he was 17 during a polygraph. MAGA County Recorder gets ass thoroughly chewed out at budget meeting. This next story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on January 29th. On Wednesday, Maricopa County Recorder Justin Heap showed up to a meeting with the County Board of Supervisors to get his budget approved. Instead, he got an ass-chewing. For nearly 2 hours, the MAGA-aligned Heap sat as multiple supervisors, including Republicans, lectured and clowned him for his office's amateurish blunders and his persistent dishonesty as the official in charge of voter registration and early voting in the county. "I have been let down by your office more times than I can count," said Board Chair Kate Brophy McGee, a centrist Republican, at the meeting. "Your automatic response to questions is to deflect, shift the blame, put line staff out in front of the camera to explain, and then go to each member's district and spread disinformation." The roasting took place during what is usually a routine meeting for the board to approve supplemental budgets for the various county agencies. Maricopa County Attorney Rachel Mitchell, another Republican who has sparred with Heap and his office, presented her budget before the recorder did. But given Heap's many scandals, sending incorrect registration cancellation mailers to 84,000 voters, not going in the office the day the mistake was discovered, lying about firing employees who'd actually quit, and multiple public spats with the board, which has now led to an ongoing lawsuit, it's hardly surprising the temperature would rise when it was Heap's turn to present. Brophy McGee grilled Heap on the stunning rate of rejected ballots during November's off-year, all-mail election. 6,000 of the roughly 700,000 ballots were rejected for having bad signatures, a rate of 0.8% that was double that of recent elections. Heap hasn't determined that any of the rejected ballots were fraudulent or in need of a criminal investigation, suggesting that many, if not all, of the rejected ballots were legitimate and that those voters were disenfranchised. Brophy McGee attempted to get an answer from Heap on how to prevent ballots from being rejected in the upcoming midterm elections. Heap repeated the line that the office was just following signature verification procedures and showed little concern about the likelihood that people's votes weren't counted. Supervisor Thomas Galvin, also a Republican and one of Heap's most vociferous critics on social media, got riled when Heap claimed that he came into office with less power than any recorder in living memory. Heap's office sued the board over claims that the board was preventing it from performing its statutory election duties. Galvin participated in the meeting by phone, and when Heap floated that claim, he couldn't help but interrupt. "Justin Heap is literally lying," Galvin said. "I was going to stay quiet, but this guy just continued to lie over and over again." The hardest grilling came from Supervisor Steve Gallardo, the board's lone Democrat. Last year, VoteBeat obtained texts showing that Heap had claimed to have Gallardo's support for toppling Galvin, who was serving as chair at the time. Gallardo publicly blasted Heap in response and asked the Arizona Attorney General's office to investigate the recorder. On Wednesday, Gallardo laid into Heap for the deeply partisan social media posts his chief of staff, Sam Stone, spends his time authoring during work hours. Stone, who has been Heap's right-hand man since the beginning of Heap's disaster-filled term 1 year ago, and who sat next to Heap at the budget meeting, regularly shits on Democrats, pushes far-right talking points, and trades outlandish takes on the platform. Gallardo referenced several Stone posts at the meeting. In August 2025, Stone wrote, "Democrats have spent the last 9 months denying elections and claiming every yo-yo conspiracy on the planet." A month later, he wrote, "Lots of Democrats, in violation of their oath, should be tossed from office." In October, Stone called elected Democrats enemies of truth, liberty, freedom, and the American way. Later that same month, he wrote, "Truly amazing how historically illiterate you have to be to vote for Democrats." In fact, the same day of the meeting, less than 30 minutes before it started, Stone wrote that we all have to pick sides in the coming civil war. He added a shrug emoji. Gallardo wasn't shrugging. How are voters supposed to have confidence in your ability to run elections when your leadership staff is saying this stuff? Gallardo said. This is disgraceful. Gallardo didn't name Stone directly, instead referring to him as a member of Heap's leadership staff. Gallardo, who spent 14 years working for the Maricopa County Elections Department before seeking elected office in the early 2000s, said former recorder Helen Purcell would have fired my ass for putting out these kinds of statements. I've been here 10 years, and I've worked with so many countywide elected officials, Gallardo said. I have never seen anyone in the county in a leadership position put out this type of statement. Never. Heap feigned innocence when confronted with these tweets from his chief of staff, claiming that he's never seen them, and Gallardo hadn't identified the member of my leadership team that you're speaking of. At least, as of Thursday afternoon, it was true that Heap doesn't follow Stone on X, where Stone makes his frequent incendiary remarks. Instead, Heap contended that everything he's done has shown nothing but impartiality, and suggested that the tweets of former recorders Adrian Fontes and Stephen Richer should also be examined. That drew a blistering response from Richer on X. Heap's predecessor shot back that Heap should find me the tweets where I bash a single elected official on anything except attacking our office. Richer also added that elected officials have different rules than staff. I imagine that's the same reason why Justin can work one out of every 5 days. Regardless of whether Heap was aware of Stone's shitposting, Gallardo said, county officials need to ensure that they're not using taxpayer resources to influence the outcome of elections. Gallardo said he hopes Stone took the day off when he tweeted this stuff out, but added he's doing it on government hours. In fact, all four of the posts Gallardo mentioned during the meeting were made during business hours on a weekday. Gallardo added that Stone's tweets might dissuade Democratic voters from seeking help from the recorder's office over a ballot issue. How do you expect me to vote for this budget knowing that your leadership team thinks this about a third of registered voters in Maricopa County, he said. How are Democrats supposed to feel with the confidence of the office when they're reading this? Facing such an onslaught, Heap got defensive. He told the board he was a little embarrassed at this personal assassination attempt dropped in a budget proposal, suggesting that Gallardo could set up a time to talk about his concerns with the office. That didn't seem to convince anyone. Both Galvin and Brophy McGee acknowledged the validity of Gallardo's concerns. Galvin asked Heap to either meet Gallardo halfway or promise to look into it and resolve it. Brophy McGee, in a somewhat stunning remark for a Republican, warned that Stone's tweets carry the danger of making your office appear or be perceived as the political arm of the far-right Republican Party. The board has taken Heap's proposed budget under advisement and has not yet voted on it. In a press release after the meeting, Heap got back on his high horse and lectured the board for its supposed unprofessionalism. He wrote that he was deeply disappointed by the board's juvenile temper tantrum, which he said was unbecoming and beneath the decorum demanded of Arizona's elected leaders, but sadly, not unexpected. This embarrassing incident clearly demonstrates why my office's lawsuit was necessary, Heap wrote, and why good faith negotiations have not been possible with a board who puts personal vendettas and unhinged political gamesmanship above the wishes of the voters. As Republican consultant Barrett Marson noted on X, the release was initially dated January 26th, 2 days before the meeting took place. Either Heap's office was sloppy with the details, or it had been working on shaping the narrative of this tongue-lashing before it even happened. It's another misstep for Heap's weighty file, as Galvin seemed to sum up during the meeting. It was really unfortunate to see the recorder's office spend the last year engaging in political games, lying about a lot of different things, and not concentrating on the task at hand, Galvin said, which is the reason why they seem to be careening from one disaster to another month by month. Writer Zach Buchanan brings us this next story, posted on January 29th. Watch out for new speed cameras along these Phoenix roadways. Starting February 23rd, Big Brother will once again be training its eye on certain valley roadways. Speed cameras have long been the bane of many valley drivers' existence, and several communities have ditched them in recent years. Phoenix did that as well, but reversed course last year when the city council appropriated money to reinstall photo radar cameras. On February 23rd, 17 such cameras will go active throughout Phoenix. The cameras will be at these locations: Thunderbird Road, 35th Avenue to Interstate 17, 32nd Street, Greenway Parkway to Bell Road, Thunderbird Road, Interstate 17 to 19th Avenue, 7th Street, Thomas Road to Indian School Road, Indian School Road, 83rd Avenue to 75th Avenue, Camelback Road, 24th Street to 32nd Street, 51st Avenue, Van Buren Street to Interstate 10, Baseline Road, 16th Street to 24th Street, and Bell Road, Interstate 17 to 19th Avenue. The city said 8 more cameras will be set up in 15-mile-per-hour school zones throughout the city. The spots were picked based on data focusing on roadways with a high number of serious and fatal injuries. Don't worry about committing these locations to heart, though. Phoenix says the cameras will move around based on road safety needs. The cameras will go live on February 23rd, but no tickets will be issued until March 25th. In between, speeders caught by the cameras will be sent a warning rather than a citation. If you're cited, you lead foot you, you can pay your fine online, in person, or via the mail. The city says the program is not intended to generate revenue, but instead is focused on roadway safety and changing driver behavior. Fines generated by the citations will be used to offset the costs to city staff and vendors. Any remaining funds will be invested in implementing the city's Vision Zero Road Safety Action Plan. Phoenix has contracted with the company Vera Mobility to operate the cameras. So, for all you speedsters out there, don't say you haven't been warned. Here's a story written by Morgan Fisher and posted on January 29th. Phoenix cop shot and killed wrong man Monday, family member says. A Southwest Phoenix family is in, quote, disarray, after a Phoenix police officer mistakenly shot and killed their patriarch on Monday instead of the intruder who broke into the family's home, the slain man's stepson told Phoenix New Times. 2 days after the shooting, the Phoenix Police Department released the victim's name as 36-year-old Christian Diaz Rendon in an updated statement after many questions surrounding this tragic and complex incident. Phoenix police have not confirmed the allegation that an officer shot and killed Rendon instead of the home intruder. Harvias Rosas, who is Rendon's 21-year-old stepson, said 7 people were in the family's house near Lower Buckeye Road and 75th Avenue on Monday evening when they heard shots coming from outside the home. Rosas was not one of them and arrived after the shooting, he said. They initially confused the shots for fireworks, but then several shots pierced through the home. Rendon told his family members to stay down and get inside their rooms as the intruders shot through the sliding glass window in the back of the home and forced his way in. The intruder, whom the family identified as the adult son of their landlord, shot one of the family's younger sons in the ankle before Rendon tackled the shooter to the ground, forced the gun out of his hand, and called 911, Rosas said. When Phoenix police arrived at the family's home, Rosas' mother, Rendon's wife, told officers that Rendon had already disarmed the intruder and was holding him down on the ground in the residence, Rosas said. But when an officer entered the home, the officer shot Rendon and not the intruder, hitting Rendon straight in the jaw, Rosas said. Rendon's jaw was completely torn off, and his blood splattered across the whole house, Rosas said, adding that Rendon tried to drag himself into the living room, but died after losing a lot of blood. In a press release soon after the shooting, Phoenix police said officers responded to the area after receiving a call that a man was shooting at the house and a family member was hit. When officers arrived, a community member said that someone was shooting people and to go in. In an updated statement Wednesday night, Phoenix police added that officers were met with people telling them that children were being shot inside the house, and the officer who approached the front door reported seeing a struggle. The officer ran toward the house and fired one round from his duty rifle through the open door. This was the moment the officer-involved shooting occurred, the department wrote in its trademark passive voice. Phoenix police said two men were taken to the hospital with non-life-threatening injuries, including the man whom police detained. Another man was pronounced dead at the scene, according to police. The names of the other people, the person who was shot or the alleged intruder, and the person who was arrested, were not provided in the release. Nor was the name of the officer who fired a weapon. The victim of the aggravated assault has been released from the hospital, and the suspect in that case remains hospitalized and will be booked on related charges upon his release, Phoenix police said in its updated statement. Phoenix police did not respond to questions about why the department hasn't released all of the names or about its response to the allegations that an officer shot the wrong man. New Times has also requested the 911 call audio, but has not received it. The Phoenix Police Department remains committed to transparency and understands that there are many questions surrounding this tragic and complex incident, the department said in a statement. We ask for patience as this investigation continues. The Arizona Department of Public Safety's Major Incident Division is investigating the shooting and the aggravated assault that occurred prior to police arrival. It did not have an update on the investigation as of Wednesday night. Sorry doesn't help. Rosas said the department has apologized to the family, but whenever we ask questions, they say that it's an ongoing investigation and that they can't disclose the information. Sorry doesn't help. Sorry is not going to put food on the table, Rosas said. Sorry is not going to pay the next month's rent. Sorry is not going to be the father figure for these kids. That's like putting a Band-Aid on a broken vase. Rosas wasn't at his home when the shooting occurred, but he made his way there after receiving a call that his brother had been shot in the ankle. When he arrived, he was told that everyone else is fine, and officers had a suspect in custody. But when he finally spoke to his family, they told a different story. When they told me that my father died, I was just in disbelief. I was in shock, Rosas said. I didn't think it actually happened. I thought maybe it was a bad dream. Maybe it was a joke. Maybe it was a prank. More than 14 hours after Rendon was shot by police, His body was finally brought outside of the residence in a body bag. And that's when everyone lost it, Rosa said. He said his mother ran through the police tape screaming, trying to get close to her husband, while officers held her back. Since the death of their patriarch at the hands of police, Rendon's family is confused and lost, Rosa said. We're all expecting him to just open the door and walk right out and say that he's fine. But he knows there's no getting out of that bag. He's not going to be able to unzip that bag and get out. Rosas described Rendon as a caring husband to his mother and someone who supported everyone in his family, as well as his neighbors. He acted as the full-time father figure to 8 kids in his life, including his biological daughter, 6 step-siblings, and one of his step-grandkids. One of Rendon's older stepsons suffers from epileptic attacks and seizures, resulting from childhood brain cancer, Rosa said. Rendon helped pay for his medical bills and attended frequent visits with his doctors. He helps out with my whole family, Rosa said, adding that Rendon has been in his life since he was 12 years old. Everyone depends on him. The family has lived in their Southwest Phoenix home since 2018 and has had a good, solid relationship with their landlord over the years. While the family has had a few positive interactions with the landlord's son, Rosa said, they don't know him very well. Some members of the family hadn't seen his face before he broke into the home on Monday. Since the incident, Rosa said, the landlord has apologized to the family for his son's actions and said that his son suffers from schizophrenia and mental disorders that likely contributed to the break-in. New Times could not confirm that detail with the landlord. Rendon's family is pushing for answers, justice, and accountability. Rosas has set up a GoFundMe to help the family pay for his father's funeral expenses. Once that person is behind bars, serves his sentence, and we get compensation, then we will forgive, Rosas said of the officer who shot his father. But at the moment, we can't find it in our hearts. Waterboarding and spicy cheese balls. ASU frat faces hazing lawsuit. This story was written by Morgan Fisher and was posted on February 28th. Last fall, a woman sued an Arizona State University fraternity for victimizing her in what she called a sex-crazed hazing ritual that involved frat brothers allegedly distributing a naked video of her. Now, the same fraternity, the ASU chapter of Sigma Alpha Epsilon, or SAE, has been hit with another lawsuit over its alleged hazing practices. On January 21st, former pledges Devin Stevens and Spencer Brajevic filed a 76-page complaint in Maricopa County Superior Court against the SAE chapter and the national organization, accusing it of negligence, intentional infliction of emotional distress, and more. 54 individual SAE members are also named as defendants in the suit. The lawsuit contains myriad claims about what Stevens and Brajevic said was a 3-month hazing ritual for pledges hoping to join SAE at the start of 2024. The two students say SAE brothers beat them with wooden paddles, compelled them to buy drugs and alcohol for frat members, required them to complete rigorous physical exercises, and also forced them to eat extremely spicy cheese balls with little water. According to the suit, pledges were forced to binge drink and consume cocaine, ketamine, and mushrooms while completing excessive exercise and memory tests, which it says often resulted in vomiting and memory loss. Pledges were also routinely required to purchase similar drugs and alcohol to be used by fraternity members. The suit claims that Stevens and Brajevic suffered severe injuries, including lacerations, contusions, and swelling, on top of tremendous emotional and mental stress and psychological illness, including aversions to certain foods. Both students say they have struggled with substance abuse and nicotine dependence as a result of the hazing, and the suit says that Stevens was forced to withdraw from school due to severely compromised grades and attendances directly attributable to the frat's hazing. Attorneys for the ASU chapter of SAE and the National Fraternity did not respond to messages seeking comment from Phoenix New Times. Jeremy Goad, the attorney for Spencer and Stevens, declined to comment. ASU spokesperson Jerry Gonzalez said that the SAE chapter was placed on interim suspension in April 2025, before the first lawsuit was filed about passing around nude videos, and officially suspended in October after the first lawsuit was reported. Gonzalez said that the new allegations are being investigated, and we encourage students with any additional information or concerns to reach out to the Dean of Students' office. Hazing details. The lawsuit offers an incredibly detailed description of the pledge process at SAE, describing a litany of ways pledges were bossed around and exploited. Some alleged hazing practices are fairly run-of-the-mill, such as being forced to set up for and clean up after parties, and being required to clean the Greek Leadership Village on ASU's Tempe campus. Other alleged hazing incidents are more eye-catching. The two students claim that the frat forced them to receive lap dances from a stripper, who then whipped their bare buttocks to the point that they received welts. In other instances, the suit says, pledges were forced to consume live fish and raw meat and ingest excessive quantities of nicotine. One alleged hazing ritual involved the forced consumption of what the complaint describes as extremely spicy cheese balls that registered 2.2 million Scoville heat units, which is hotter than the infamous Carolina Reaper pepper. The suit says the roughly two dozen pledges were given only a half gallon of water to share during the ritual, and as a result, experienced vomiting and stomach pain. Despite that, the pledges were then forced to do burpees, calisthenics, and brother squats, in which two pledges face each other in the squat position while holding hands and saying, "I love you." Pledges were also regularly forced to binge drink, per the complaint. During one of these binge drinking episodes, one pledge allegedly became so severely drunk that he became unresponsive on the ground. The complaint says other pledges had to beg older fraternity members to let him receive medical attention. The pledge eventually ended up in the hospital, the complaint says, and later indicated that he would have died had he not received emergency medical care. That same evening, the complaint says, Brajevic was forced to drive a pledge home while intoxicated and was stopped by police and arrested for drunk driving. Tempe municipal court records show Brajevic eventually pleaded down to a charge of reckless driving, a Class 2 misdemeanor. The suit also describes several instances in which pledges were put through demanding physical tasks. Per the suit, pledges were routinely forced to perform physical exercises such as squats, sit-ups, and push-ups as punishment for failing certain tasks or pledge tests. One ritual involved being forced to perform a, quote, human bridge, in which they assumed plank positions while other pledges walked across their backs, placing compressive force on their spines. Afterward, the complaint says, Stevens was forced to complete a second workout at the Muscle Factory gym that caused him severe abdominal cramping, loss of bowel control, and chest pain. He was taken to the emergency room and was allegedly told not to inform medical personnel that he was pledging with the fraternity. Another ritual involved filming so-called weatherman videos, in which pledges were forced to film themselves being struck by eggs launched with hockey sticks while wearing only their underwear, submerging themselves in bodies of water at temperatures well below freezing, diving naked into swimming pools, being subjected to electric shocks from tasers, and being doused with flour and other substances. The complaint says the videos were filmed to provide sadistic amusement and entertainment to fraternity members. During one ritual described in the complaint, some pledges were sent into a bathroom, which brothers allegedly called Auschwitz, where they were waterboarded, which the complaint describes as standing in a cold shower, having water sprayed into their mouths, having their mouths covered with a rag, and water poured on the rag. Several pledges were also allegedly injured in a jousting event during the Frats Beer Olympics, with one pledge suffering a serious back injury after falling from another pledge's shoulders and a second falling into and shattering a glass window. In addition to binge drinking and physical punishment, the complaint says pledges had to essentially work as personal assistants for older members, acting as their chauffeurs for dates, picking up food, and paying for alcohol and supplies for fraternity-hosted events. Pledges also had to clean the fraternity house, which was left in squalid and biohazardous conditions, and do members' laundry. The complaint says one pledge spent in excess of $8,000 in out-of-pocket costs, buying things for older members, including controlled substances. Hazing controversies with SAE at Arizona State aren't new. In 2012, 19-year-old pledge Jack Koulalias drowned in the Salt River after binge drinking at a pledge event. A few months later, another fraternity member was dumped at a hospital with a note after a tequila drinking contest that nearly killed him. The 20-year-old student had a blood alcohol level of 0.47, nearly five times over the legal limit. The two high-profile incidents led to ASU expelling the chapter from the university in 2013, revoking its university recognition. The following year, the National Fraternity instituted a ban on hazing. According to the suit from Spencer and Stevens, the National Fraternity knew or should have known the extent of hazing at its ASU chapter. Related lawsuit. Goad, the attorney for the two students, is also representing the female student suing SAE over sharing her nude photos. The new lawsuit makes oblique mention to the first one, saying that pledges could avoid the frat's bedmaking requirement if a woman had slept over, provided a pledge recorded the female in his bed and transmitted that to frat brothers. The females recorded were not informed they were being filmed, the complaint says, nor that the recordings were being disseminated. The first lawsuit is still working its way through court, though one of the brothers named in that suit, there's a great deal of overlap among the defendants in both lawsuits, has responded in court. New Times has not named the parties to that first suit due to the sexual nature of the claims that it involves. In a 148 response and counterclaim against the woman who filed the lawsuit, the SAE member claimed he and the woman had an intimate sexual relationship and that she consented to his taking the video and sharing it with a few friends, which he said was not an uncommon request. He said the couple was comfortable being nude around each other and documented much of their lives through their phones, which included taking and sharing photos of each other at various stages of undress. These types of risque photos were typical for their interactions, the court filing reads. The photos were mutual, reciprocal, co-produced, and consensual. The video in question was a short 2 to 3 second clip taken on Snapchat of both of them naked from the waist up. The short video alternated between the two of them in frame, and she was looking directly at the camera and leaning into and against him. She was not asleep, unconscious, or unwilling, the frat member's response says. The woman's lawsuit did not claim that she was unconscious or unaware she was being filmed. However, it did say, about the video sharing ritual generally, that even if the subject of the illicit photo or video consented to their photograph or video being taken, that does not mean that they also consented to their intimate photo being shared with hundreds of strangers on campus as part of a long-standing hazing ritual. The man claimed he was not responsible for sharing the video with the fraternity, saying he didn't save the video after sending it and had assumed it was gone and long forgotten. In a separate response in court, another fraternity member who allegedly shared the video in an SAE group chat also denied that he received it directly from the man who took it. Instead, the man who filmed the nude video claimed that the woman and her current boyfriend, who is allegedly one of the plaintiffs in the second lawsuit, launched a campaign to destroy his reputation and future at ASU over the video. After the video was shared in the group chat, he claimed that he and people who supported him were met with a campaign of harassing, intimidating, and bullying by the couple. Due to the fallout, he left the fraternity in March 2025 and withdrew from the university 2 months later. He's since enrolled in online classes at Southern New Hampshire University to complete his degree, per court records. And that brings us to the end of this week's program. Thanks very much for listening to Stories from the Phoenix New Times. Please stay tuned for other interesting programs. I'm your Sun Sounds volunteer, Chip Hawbrook.